The following is a community affairs presentation from the Ulster County Health Department. This is the Healthy Ulster Radio Show, a weekly presentation exploring community health and sustainability with guests representing a broad spectrum of community partners working to make Ulster County the healthiest in New York State. This program is sponsored by the Health Alliance of the Hudson Valley in Kingston, a member of the WMC Health Network.
Good morning. You are listening to Healthy Ulster Radio. I am your host, Dr. Carol Smith, Commissioner of Health and Mental Health for Ulster County. With me this morning is my co-host, Vin Martello, our Director of Community Health Relations. Good morning, Vin.
Good morning, Dr. Smith. How are you?
Good, thank you.
Dr. Smith, today we have a really good topic, and it is Catholic Charities and the amazing work that they do. All over the country and here in the Mid-Hudson Valley region and right here in Ulster County. Catholic Charities does a lot of great work in terms of helping those who are suffering from the disease of addiction, families and individuals struggling with poverty, immigrants navigating the journey to citizenship. But I will refrain from providing the details because we have a great guest, and he is Dean Scherer, who's CEO of Catholic Charities of Orange, Sullivan, and Ulster. Welcome, Dean.
Welcome. Thank you, Vin. Thank you, Dr. Smith.
Can we start by giving our listeners just a little brief history of Catholic Charities and an overview of how it got started and how it came into being?
Certainly. Catholic Charities of Orange, Sullivan, and Ulster.
Or just in general, I'm part of the larger organization and how the local one fits into that.
So we are a subsidiary, for lack of a better word, mm-hmm. of the Catholic Charities of mm-hmm. the Archdiocese of New York. We're one of 90 agencies that are part of the Federation that serves the Metropolitan and Mid-Hudson region. Mm-hmm. Catholic Charities of Orange, Sullivan, and Ulster is a separate legal entity with a local board, and we provide some services through Catholic Charities of the Archdiocese mm-hmm. by contract. For example, our emergency food and shelter case management services mm-hmm. Is funded through the Catholic Charities. So they ask us to do this work for them. We do it in all three counties. We assist people with rent, utilities, emergency funding, with the idea of helping those people who hover at the poverty level, who with our assistance will be able to sustain and maintain their autonomy. Mm-hmm. So sometimes it's maybe simply helping them with a one-time car insurance payment so they can get to work.
And all of those things. And we know that you provide a lot of substance use prevention and treatment services. We know that because we have worked with you. You've been in our opioid task force, working with our Department of Mental Health and our community partners. So for our listeners' sake, let's talk for a moment about about addiction. There's a lot of misinformation surrounding it. Some people might think that it's some kind of moral failing. Others, a character flaw of some type. What is addiction, really?
Addiction is considered a brain disease, not unlike hypertension, not unlike heart disease, not unlike diabetes. We don't really understand fully what causes it. Genetic predisposition can put somebody's risk factor at about 50%, but we also know that adverse experiences in childhood can contribute significantly to the development of all sorts of diseases, including addiction and mental illness.
Mm-hmm. And some of these addictive substances we have found through various kinds of studies, imaging studies and the like, actually create some functional and structural changes in the brain itself. Opioids are one of them, so that the individual who becomes addicted in the first place winds up craving more and more of the substance as a result of some of these organic changes mm-hmm. in the brain.
Mm-hmm. And if it is truly a chronic disease, why is there so much stigma surrounding it, and why are there so many barriers to treatment out there, from your perspective?
I'm not sure about the why, mm-hmm. but the stigma can be even evidenced in how we approach educating our medical students. In 2017, I believe less than 10% of our medical schools taught full curriculums mm-hmm. on the disease of addiction. Mm-hmm. And you know, I think the sense of shame, the social impact of mm-hmm. shame mm-hmm. has a profound impact on how we view addiction mm-hmm. as a moral, as you said, a moral failing or a social failing. Mm-hmm. As parents, when we have children who suffer from addiction, you know, we tend to blame ourselves and look at what did we do wrong. Mm-hmm. It's a significant barrier to, mm-hmm. to treatment.
And if, you know, many people out there, lay persons who have never had any experience with addiction or even a family member, might think of treatment as a one-size-fits-all proposition, similar to Alcoholics Anonymous, where somebody goes into an abstinence program and then they stay there for X amount of time and then they're done and it's all over. What's the reality, and what are the many, what can you just briefly review some of the options that are available through your agency and others that you're aware of?
Sure. So Catholic Charities, and I want to note this, provides treatment and services to individuals regardless of their religion and regardless of their ability to pay. And we offer a fairly robust continuum of services, from medically monitored and medically supervised detox to day rehabilitation to outpatient services to community-based departments for people who are in recovery, as well as community-based services that includes medication-assisted treatment through telepractice, telemedicine.
Mm-hmm. And you emphasize, I mean, I've read that, you know, these family-based approaches are really very effective because it's really the social support networks mm-hmm. surrounding that individual. Is that something that you're focused on?
We do. We do try to incorporate families in all aspects of our care. We also offer free support groups in many counties for people who've lost a loved one through an overdose.
Mm-hmm. Kind of like a grief support.
Correct.
I know that Carol Sutcliffe, also our family advocate, has a group to do that now as well. And folks have heard about Narcan and, you know, its ability to reverse overdoses, where high dosages of synthetic opioids are involved. It may not work and without multiple doses, but talk about that for a moment.
Well, essentially, Narcan closes the door to the receptors, preventing, you know, the opioids from getting in there and just halting breathing. Mm-hmm. So it's a life-saving tool.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The one thing that I have started to emphasize, though, just by way of making sure that the complete message is out there, is that, you know, Narcan's been around for a long time. When I was in school, it was a tool that we would use to reverse overdoses in the emergency room. But, you know, the issue currently is that fentanyl, which is an analog, an opiate analog that is about 100 times the strength of morphine, is so potent that it often takes several Narcan kits to reverse that overdose. And individuals who are taking opiates via injections or, you know, the substances they may have derived either on the street or through the internet or what have you, that if fentanyl is present, and it's not known really sometimes how much fentanyl is present, the one Narcan kit may not reverse that overdose. So I think that's important to make sure that the drug using community has that message out there. And
right, it's not a magic wand.
It's not. Mm-mm, I mean, no. You know, heroin is one thing, fentanyl is another.
Mm-hmm. And Dean, you know, one of the things that we discovered with our opioid prevention task force, and we did a lot of research as to best and promising practices from around the country, but the other half of what we learned are all of the places where the current system is fragmented. And it's really through no ill intention. It's the way that funding, you know, provides funding for this source and that organization and this grant program, and you have the different offices up in the state all funding separately. But we found that in some sense the system is a little bit fragmented, and it's not really in the programs, like whether in jails or programs where people overdose and perhaps die. It's what happens when they get out and that transition to their back to their lives and back to the community. And we know that you're very involved through it, with that work through your peer advocates. Can you talk about that for a moment?
Certainly. Peer advocates play an essential role in helping people find recovery. I mean, how active we are as providers is directly proportional to how progressed one's disease of addiction is. We need to create much more of a safety net and much more of an active presence for people who are more advanced in their disease of addiction. And peer advocates serve many functions. One certainly is to reduce the stigma of shame. Peer advocates are people typically who've been in recovery successfully themselves for a period of time. And it can be very reassuring to say to you, hey, look, I've been there. There's hope. And I can help you navigate what needs to be done to help you in your road to recovery.
And we'll get into some examples of that. But first, we're going to take a short break. You're listening to Healthy Ulster Radio. Back soon.
I love the way that picture looks. Can you move it to the left just a bit? Careful on the ladder.
Really? You know I'm always careful. Let me move it just a little bit more. Uh-oh!
Let's face it, accidents happen. When life takes an unexpected turn, you want your family treated at a full-service emergency room, where you'll find physicians who are board-certified in emergency medicine.
Let's get in the car. We're going to the ER.
Oh, but we'll be waiting for hours.
Introducing the 30 minutes or less ER pledge, only at Mid-Hudson Regional Hospital in Poughkeepsie and Health Alliance Hospital in Kingston, members of the WMC Health Network. When you arrive in either of these emergency rooms, you'll be seen by a member of the care team within 30 minutes. Expert trusted emergency care without the wait. To read the 30 minutes or less ER pledge, visit wmchealth.org/ER30.
Well, that was painless.
Hey, I'm the one with the stitches.
No, I was talking about the wait.
Another way the WMC Health Network is advancing care here.
Raising kids can be tough these days. As a parent, you've got your hands full making sure your kids have what they need to stay healthy and get the care they need when they're sick. Well, now there's help. Medicaid and the Children's Health Insurance Program offer free or low-cost health insurance for kids and teens, all the way up to age 19. They can get regular checkups, immunizations, doctor and dentist visits, hospital care, mental health services, prescriptions, and more. Children in a family of four earning up to $47,100 a year may qualify. It's a helping hand for parents with their hands full. For more information about free or low-cost children's health insurance in your state, go to chipmedicaid.org or call 1-877-KIDS-NOW. That's 1-877-543-7669. A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
Let me ask you a question. When you think of the American Legion, what comes to mind?
Is it the way we fight daily for our veterans to get them the benefits they've earned through their service?
I work hard every day to make sure that our veterans get the benefits they deserve. I am the American Legion.
For nearly 100 years, the American Legion has been our nation's leading advocate for veterans and their families.
I am the American Legion.
This is today's American Legion.
To learn more, visit legion.org.
Welcome back. You are listening to Healthy Ulster Radio. Our special guest today is Dr. Dean Scher, CEO from Catholic Charities of Orange, Sullivan, and Ulster. Before the break, Dean, we were talking about the peer advocacy concept and the peer advocates that Catholic Charities has within your organization. Can you tell us a little bit more about how do peer advocates work and what organizations are they working with, or how do people connect with them?
Our peer advocates work with a host of organizations, from hospital emergency departments, the criminal justice system, including the jails and drug treatment courts, the police,
Police agencies.
Yeah, the police agencies, mm-hmm. pretty much all of the criminal justice systems. We work in warming stations, in homeless shelters, and we try, the focus is to try to meet an individual where they're at and to assess how we could help, whether it be with what their next meal might be or how they're going to get their next meal or where they're going to sleep, or if they're more interested or contemplative about accessing services, talking, trying to instill hope in individuals who suffer from right. the disease of addiction.
And that's a very critical, vulnerable time, because very often if they're in jail or in a program where they've been in abstinence, and they're now, their tolerance is a lot lower, and they're coming back out into the community with their, you know, maybe not sufficient social supports, or maybe going back to their pre-existing habits or what have you, and the loneliness and isolation. Mm. That's a really critical time, mm-hmm. right? And having that
very
person.
Very critical.
Yeah. Yeah, I know you guys are doing some really good work, and we've heard it up in Albany and other all over.
Thank
you know,
you.
About that critical function. And Dean, you were talking earlier during the break about the difficulty of overcoming addiction and its effect on the brain as a chronic disease. Can you tell our listeners about that?
Sure. So, for example, with a drug like heroin or any opioid, it interferes with the brain's ability to produce serotonin. And it can take the brain anywhere from 6 to 18 months when someone stops using an opioid to redevelop the ability to produce serotonin. So if someone stops using a drug, they're going to feel worse before they feel better. And it's hard to derail one's attention from the intense discomfort that one has when they're withdrawing. That's where the role of medication-assisted treatment can be most effective. Drugs like Vivitrol or Suboxone provide the brain with some homeostatic process mm-hmm. while the brain is working to redevelop the capacity to produce serotonin. So, sadly, you know, the earlier one starts using an opioid, like if one starts as a teenager, a 14, 15-year-old, and it's a protracted use. Unfortunately, there are some people's brains who never redevelop the capacity to produce serotonin and will require medication, likely for the rest of their life. It's like someone with type 1 diabetes. Mm-hmm. They require insulin for the rest of their life.
Mm-hmm. And so a lot of the you know, misinformation and objections to these, whether it's methadone or Vivitrol, Suboxone, people have said in some quarters that, you know, it's just substituting one drug for another. It's really not about that, right?
No, it's about creating homeostasis. Mm-hmm. Again, research and literature, for example, out of Harvard, indicates that it's no coincidence the drug or drugs of choice that we choose. You know, the literature says that, for example, people who may suffer from depression are much more inclined to abuse drugs like cocaine or amphetamine. Mm-hmm. People who have a hard time regulating feelings of anger and rage mm-hmm. are much more inclined to abuse opioids. Mm-hmm. So helping people to find the proper medication mm-hmm. to create homeostasis, you mm-hmm. know, in terms of brain function is important.
And we know now, too, that many people slipped into addiction without really understanding what it's about through prescriptions from mm-hmm. their own healthcare providers, mm-hmm. through other means, maybe recreational use, where they thought, oh, well, you know, I'm immune to this. This mm-hmm. is not going to get me. But mm-hmm. there's almost no one who mm-hmm. has suffered from addiction that has, almost everyone yeah. has said, you know, not me, but yeah. they're,
you know, as a physician and having seen what's happened with the pharmaceutical industry and the kind of promotions that they were launching in order to sell some of these opioid drugs, they definitely underestimated mm. or underreported the addictive potential of some of mm. these medications. Mm-hmm. So, you know, a well-being prescriber, doctor, whatever, was trying to treat somebody's pain may have in fact prescribed it, and the person may become addicted even after a short period on that particular substance. People differ in terms of how liable they are to become addicted after a short or a long period.
It can happen in 5 days.
It can happen relatively quickly in some individuals. So that has been a problem that, you know, we are trying to address in terms of kind of resetting that so that those medications or drugs are really reserved for people at the end stages of life with severe cancer pain or what have you, and not just for any particular ache or pain that somebody may be contending with on a daily basis. So not to underestimate the power of pain and the need to deal with it, but there are other ways to deal with pain rather than resorting to these highly, highly addictive drugs.
Which leads us really to the discussion that, that opioids don't necessarily have to be the default choice, that really there's a lot of talk in health and public health circles now about really coming up with a comprehensive pain management program that considers alternative modalities. Can you talk about those for us, Dean? I know that you mentioned holistic approaches in your notes and other things.
Well, in a broader sense, yeah, there are many more options that, and in terms of approaches to treating pain management, putting that issue aside. I mean, if you accept that, that addiction is a disease, we don't know what causes it, but it reflects my bias, the brain's attempt to maintain some equilibrium so that it doesn't short circuit. And some people may be born with a predisposition to have a hard time regulating their feelings. Many people who become addicted also have significant adverse childhood experiences. So when somebody is in recovery, we're asking them to stop using a drug and put their attention on the very things their brain has taught them not to attend to.
Right.
And so a holistic approach involves things like teaching people to pay attention to their feelings, to mindfulness, to the understanding that, and we know from brain imaging that certain experiences tend to stay in our brainstem and never make it to our cortex, and we carry that around. And the idea of a holistic approach, talking and mindfulness, and sometimes medication to ensure that someone isn't inundated with and flooded with too much feeling, provides an opportunity for people to more permanently find relief from suffering.
Yeah, it's interesting. I met a young woman at a recent conference who was, you know, started drinking at a sleepover when she was 15, became addicted, homeless, multiple warrants for her arrest based on criminal activity to support her habit, came out of it eventually. She's now in her late 20s, a mom, running a wellness recovery organization. And she said she didn't know, but she was suffering from depression and anxiety, and the drugs were like a warm blanket that surrounded her. But what she learned in this process was that you can achieve that level of comfort and happiness and warmth and love without the drugs by substituting other things that are really important. Can you tell us, if folks want to, Dean, we are running out of time, unfortunately, how folks get in touch with Catholic Charities?
Sure. Our Kingston Ulster office is 845-340-9170. And our after-hours number is 845-467-0861.
That's really terrific. Well, thank you so much
thank
for
you,
all
Dean.
The work
thank
that you,
you
and
time.
Your colleagues do. It really is, it's so, so vitally important. And we hope that folks will take it to heart and help in this fight. So thank you. You're listening to Healthy Ulster Radio. Tune in next week for more great information that you can use to keep yourself, your family, and our community healthy and strong.
You've been listening to the Healthy Ulster Radio Show, a community affairs presentation from the Ulster County Health Department, sponsored by Health Alliance of the Hudson Valley in Kingston, a member of the WMC Health Network. Thanks for listening, and be sure to join us for another edition of the Healthy Ulster Radio Show next week.